18. Assassinations. Chade Falstar, a personal advisor to King Shrood, made an extensive study of forging during the period just preceding the Red Ship Wars. From his tablets, we have the following. Netta, daughter of the fisherman Gil and the farmer Ryder, was taken alive from her village Goodwater on the 17th day after Springfest. She was forged by the Red Ship Raiders and returned to her village 3 days later. Her father was killed in the same raid, and her mother, having 5 younger children, was little able to deal with Netta. She was, at the time of her forging, 14 summers old. She came into my possession some 6 months after her forging. When first brought to me, she was dirty, ragged, and greatly weakened due to starvation and exposure. At my direction, she was washed, clothed, and housed in chambers convenient to my own. I proceeded with her as I might have with a wild animal. Each day I brought her food with my own hands and stayed by her while she ate. I saw to it that her chambers were kept warm, her bedding clean, and that she was provided with the amenities a woman might expect, water for washing, brushes and combs, and all that is needful to a woman. In addition, I saw to it that she was furnished with sundry supplies for needlework, for I had discovered that prior to forging, she had had a great fondness for doing such fancy work, and had created several artful pieces. My intention in all of this was to see if, under gentle circumstances, a forged one might not return to a semblance of the person she had formerly been. Even a wild animal might have become a little tamer under these circumstances, but to all things, Netta reacted with indifference. She had lost not only the habits of a woman, but even the good sense of an animal. She would eat to satiation with her hands, and then let fall to the floor whatever was excess, to be trodden underfoot. She did not wash, nor care for herself in any way. Even most animals soil only one area of their dens, but as for Netta, she was like a mouse that lets her droppings fall everywhere, with no care for bedding. She was able to speak in a sensible way if she chose to, or wanted some item badly enough. When she spoke by her own choice, it was usually to accuse me of stealing from her, or to utter threats against me if I did not immediately give her some item she had decided she wanted. Her habitual attitude toward me was suspicious and hateful. She ignored my attempts at normal conversation, but by withholding food from her, I was able to elicit answers in exchange for food. She had clear memory of her family, but had no interest in what had become of them. Rather, she answered those questions as if answering questions about yesterday's weather. Of her forging time, she said only that they had been in the belly of a ship, and that there had been little food and only enough water to go around. She had been fed nothing unusual that she recalled, nor had she been touched in any way that she remembered. Thus, she could furnish to me no clue as to the mechanism of forging itself. This was a great disappointment to me, for I had hoped that by learning how a thing was done, a man could discover how to undo it. I endeavored to bring human behavior back to her by reasoning with her, but to no avail. She appeared to understand my words, but would not act on them. Even when given 2 loaves of bread and warned that she must save one for the morrow or go hungry, she would let her second loaf fall to the floor, tread upon it, and on the morrow, eat her own dropped leavings, careless of what dirt clung to them. She evinced no interest in her needlework, or in any other pastime, not even the bright toys of a child. If not eating or sleeping, she was content merely to sit or lie, her mind as idle as her body. Offered sweets or pastries, she would indulge until she vomited, and then eat more. I treated her with sundry elixirs and herbal teas. I fasted her, I steamed her, I purged her body. Hot and cold dowsings had no effect other than to make her hungry. I caused her to sleep a full day and a night, to no change. I so charged her with elf bark that she could not sleep for 2 nights, but this only made her irritable. I spoiled her with kindness for a time, but as when I treated her with the harshest restrictions, it made no difference to her, or in how she regarded me. If hungry, she would make courtesies and smile pleasantly when commanded to, but as soon as food was furnished her, all further commands and requests were ignored. She was viciously jealous of territory and possessions. More than once she attempted to attack me, for no more reason than that I had ventured too close to food she was eating, and once because she suddenly decided she wished to have a ring I was wearing. She regularly killed the mice her untidiness attracted, snatching them up with amazing swiftness and dashing them against the wall. A cat that once ventured into her chambers met with a similar fate. She seemed to have little sense of the time that had passed since her forging. She could give no good account of her earlier life if commanded when hungry, but of the days since her forging, all was one long yesterday to her. From Netta, I could not learn if something had been added to her or taken away to forge her. I did not know if it was a thing consumed or smelled or heard or seen. I did not know if it was even the work of a man's hand or art, or the work of a sea demon such as some Farlanders claim to have power upon. From a long and weary experiment, I learned nothing. To Netta, I gave a triple sleeping draught one evening with her water. I had her body bathed, her hair groomed, and sent her back to her village to be decently buried. At least one family could put fini to a tale of forging. Most others must wonder, for months and years, what has become of the one they once held dear. Most are better off not knowing. There were, at that time, over 1,000 souls known to have been forged. Burridge had meant what he said. He had nothing more to do with me. I was no longer welcome down at the stables and kennels. Cobb especially took savage pleasure in this. Although he was often gone with Regal, when he was about the stables he would often step to block my entry. "Allow me to bring you your horse, master," he would say obsequiously. "The stable master prefers that grooms handle animals within the stables." And so I must stand like some incompetent lordling while Sooty was saddled and brought for me. Cobb himself mucked her stall and brought her feed and groomed her, and it ate at me like acid to see how quickly she welcomed him back. She was only a horse, I told myself, and not to be blamed. But it was one more abandonment. I had too much time, suddenly. Mornings had always been spent working for Burridge. Now they were mine. Hard was busy training green men for defense. I was welcome to drill with them, but it was all lessons I had learned long ago. Fedrin was gone for the summer, as he was every summer. I could not think of a way to apologize to Patience, and I did not even think about Molly. Even my forays to the taverns in Buckkeep had become solitary ones. Carey had apprenticed to a puppeteer, and Dirk gone for a sailor. I was idle and alone. It was a summer of misery, and not just for me. While I was lonely and bitter and outgrowing all my clothes, while I snapped and snarled at any foolish enough to speak to me and drank myself insensible several times a week, I was still aware of how the 6 duchies were racked. The Red Ship raiders, bolder than ever before, harried our coastline. This summer, in addition to threats, they finally began to make demands. Grain, cattle, the right to take whatever they wished from our seaports, the right to beach their boats and live off our lands and people for the summer, their choice of our folk for slaves. Each demand was more intolerable than the last, and the only thing more intolerable than the demands were the forgings that followed each refusal by the king. Common folk were abandoning the seaport and waterfront towns. One could not blame them, but it left our coastline even more vulnerable. More soldiers were hired, and more, and so the levies were raised to pay them, and folk grumbled under the burden of the taxes and their fear of the Red Ship raiders. Even stranger were the out-islanders who came to our shore in their family ships, their raiding vessels left behind, to beg asylum of our people, and to tell wild tales of chaos and tyranny in the Out Islands, where the Red Ships now ruled completely. They were mixed blessings, perhaps. They were cheaply hired as soldiers, though few really trusted them. But at least their tales of the Out Islands under Red Ship domination were harrowing enough to keep anyone from thinking of giving in to the raiders' demands. About a month after my return, Chade opened his door to me. I was sullen over his neglect of me, and went more slowly up his stairs than ever I had before. But when I got there, he looked up from crushing seeds with a pestle and a face full of weariness. "I am glad to see you," he said, with nothing of gladness in his voice. "That's why you were so swift to welcome me back," I answered sourly. He stopped his grinding. "I'm sorry. I thought perhaps you would need a time alone to recover yourself." He looked back to his seeds. "It has not been an easy winter and spring for me either. Shall we try to put the time behind us and go on?" It was a gentle, reasonable suggestion. I knew it was wise. "Have I any choice?" I asked sarcastically. Chade finished grinding his seed. He scraped it into a finely woven sieve and put it under a cup to drip. "No," he said at last, as if he had considered it well. "No, you don't, and neither do I. In many things we have no choice." He looked at me, his eyes running up and down me, and then poked at his seed again. "You," he said, "will stop drinking anything but water or tea for the rest of the summer. Your sweat stinks of wine, and for one so young your muscles are lax. A winter of Galen's meditations has done your body no good at all. See that you exercise it. Take it upon yourself, as of today, to climb to Verity's tower 4 times a day. You will take him food, and the teas I will show you how to prepare. You will never show him a sullen face, but will always be cheerful and friendly. Perhaps a while of waiting on Verity will convince you that I've had reasons for my attention not being centered on you. That is what you will do each day you are at Buckkeep. There will be some days when you will be fulfilling other assignments for me." It had not taken many words from Chade to awaken shame in myself. My perception of my life crashed from high tragedy to juvenile self-pity in a matter of moments. "I have been idle," I admitted. "You have been stupid," Chade agreed. "You had a month in which to take charge of your own life. You behaved like a spoiled brat. I have no wonder that Burridge is disgusted with you." I had long ago stopped being surprised at what Chade knew, but this time I was sure he did not know the real reason, and I had no desire to share it with him. "Have you discovered yet who tried to kill him?"
"I haven't tried, really."
Now Chade looked disgusted, and then puzzled.
"Boy, you are not yourself at all. 6 months ago you would have torn the stables apart to know such a secret. 6 months ago, given a month's holiday, you would have filled each day. What troubles you?"
I looked down, feeling the truth of his words. I wanted to tell him everything that had befallen me. I wanted not to say a word of it to anyone. "I'll tell you all I do know of the attack on Burridge." And I did.
"And the one who saw all this?"
he asked when I had finished.
"Did he know the man who attacked Burridge?"
"He didn't get a good look at him." I hedged. Useless to tell Chade that I knew exactly how he smelled, but had only a vague visual image. Chade was quiet for a moment.
"Well, as much as you can, keep an ear to the earth. I should like to know who has grown so brave as to kill the king's stablemaster in his own stable."
"Then you do not think it was just some personal quarrel of Burridge's?" I asked carefully.
"Perhaps it was, but we will not jump to conclusions. To me, it has the feel of a gambit. Someone is building to something, but has missed their first block."
to our advantage, I hope.
Can you tell me why you think so?
I could, but I will not. I want to leave your mind free to find its own assumptions, independent of mine. Now come. I will show you the teas.
I was more than a bit hurt that he asked me nothing about my time with Galen, or my test. He seemed to accept my failure as a thing expected. But as he showed me the ingredients he had chosen for Verity's teas, I was horrified by the strength of the stimulants he was using. I had seen little of my Verity. Though Regal had been only too much in evidence, he had spent the last month coming and going. He was always just returning or just leaving, and each cavalcade seemed richer and more ornate than the one before. It seemed to me that he was using the excuse of his brother's courting to feather himself more brightly than any peacock. Common opinion was that he must go so to impress those he negotiated with. For myself, I saw it as a waste of coin that could have gone to defences. When Regal was gone, I felt relief, for his antagonism toward me had taken a recent bound, and he had found sundry small ways to express it. The brief times when I had seen Verity or the King, they had both looked harassed and worn, but Verity especially had seemed almost stunned. Impassive and distracted, he had noticed me only once and then smiled wearily and said I had grown. That had been the extent of our conversation. But I had noticed that he ate like an invalid, without appetite, eschewing meat and bread as if they were too great of an effort to chew and swallow, and instead subsisting on porridges and soups.
He is using the skill too much. That much Shrewd has told me. But why it should drain him so, why it should burn the very flesh from his bones, he cannot explain to me. So I give him tonics and elixirs and try to get him to rest, but he cannot, he dares not, he says. He tells me that only all his efforts are sufficient to delude the Red Ship navigators, to send their ships onto the rocks, to discourage their captains. And so he rises from bed and goes to his chair by a window, and there he sits all day.
And Galen's coterie? Are they of no use to him? I asked the question almost jealously, almost hoping to hear they were of no consequence. Chade sighed.
I think he uses them as I would use carrier pigeons. He has sent them out to the towers, and he uses them to convey warnings to his soldiers, and to receive from them sightings of ships. But the task of defending the coast he trusts to no one else. Others, he tells me, would be too inexperienced. They might betray themselves to those they skilled. I do not understand, but I know he cannot continue much longer. I pray for the end of summer, for winter storms to blow the Red Ships home. Would there was someone to spell him at this work. I fear it will consume him.
I took that as a rebuke for my failure, and subsided into a sulky silence. I drifted around his chambers, finding them both familiar and strange after my months of absence. The apparatus for his herbal work was, as always, cluttered about. Slink was very much in evidence, with his smelly bits of bones in corners. As always, there was an assortment of tablets and scrolls by various chairs. This crop seemed to deal mostly with elderlings. I wandered about, intrigued by the coloured illustrations. One tablet, older and more elaborate than the rest, depicted an elderling as a sort of gilded bird, with a man-like head crowned with quillish hair. I began to piece out the words. It was in Peish, an ancient native tongue of Chalcid, the southernmost duchy. Many of the painted symbols had faded or flaked away from the old wood, and I had never been fluent in Peish. Chade came to stand at my elbow.
"You know," he said gently, "it was not easy for me, but I kept my word. Galen demanded complete control of his students. He expressly stipulated that no one might contact you or interfere in any way with your discipline and instruction. And as I told you in the Queen's Garden, I am blind without influence."
I knew that,
I muttered.
Yet I did not disagree with Burrich's actions. Only my word to my king kept me from contacting you.
He paused cautiously.
It has been a difficult time, I know. I wish I could have helped you. And you should not feel too badly that you failed.
I filled in the word while he searched for a gentler one. I sighed, and suddenly admitted my pain.
Let's leave it, Chade. I can't change it.
I know. Then, even more carefully,
but perhaps we can use what you learned of the skill. If you can help me understand it, perhaps I can devise better ways to spare Verity. For so many years the knowledge has been kept too secret. There is scarcely a mention of it in the old scrolls, save to say that such and such a battle was turned by the king's skill upon his soldiers, or such and such an enemy was confounded by the king's skill. Yet there is nothing of how it is done, or...
Despair closed its grip on me again.
Leave it. It is not for bastards to know. I think I've proved that.
A silence fell between us. At last, Chade sighed heavily.
Well, that's as may be. I've been looking into forging as well over these last few months, but all I've learned of it is what it is not, and what does not work to change it. The only cure I've found for it is the oldest one known to work on anything.
I rolled and fastened the scroll I had been looking at, feeling I knew what was coming. I was not mistaken.
The king has charged me with an assignment for you.
That summer, over 3 months, I killed 17 times for the king. Had I not already killed out of my own volition and defense, it might have been harder. The assignments might have seemed simple. Me, a horse, and panniers of poisoned bread. I rode roads where travelers had reported being attacked, and when the forged ones attacked me, I fled, leaving a trail of spilled loaves. Perhaps if I had been an ordinary man-at-arms, I would have been less frightened. But all my life I had been accustomed to relying on my wit to let me know when others were about. To me it was tantamount to having to work without using my eyes, and I swiftly found out that not all forged ones had been cobblers and weavers. The second little clan of them that I poisoned had several soldiers among them. I was fortunate that most of them were squabbling over loaves when I was dragged from my horse. I took a deep cut from a knife, and to this day I bear the scar on my left shoulder. They were strong and competent, and seemed to fight as a unit, perhaps because that was how they had been drilled, back when they were fully human. I would have died, except that I cried out to them that it was foolish to struggle with me while the others were eating all the bread. They dropped me. I struggled to my horse and escaped. The poisons were no crueler than they had to be, but to be effective, even in the smallest dosage, we had to use harsh ones. The forged ones did not die gently, but it was as swift a death as Chade could concoct. They snatched their deaths from me eagerly, and I did not have to witness their frothing convulsions or even see their bodies by the road. When news of the fallen forged ones reached Buckkeep, Chade's tale that they had probably died from eating spoiled fish from spawning streams had already spread as a ubiquitous rumor. Relatives collected the bodies and gave them proper burial. I told myself they were probably relieved, and that the forged ones had met a quicker end than if they had starved to death over the winter. And so I became accustomed to killing, and had nearly a score of deaths to my credit before I had to meet the eyes of a man, and then kill him. That one, too, was not so difficult as it might have been. He was a minor lordling, holding lands outside of Terlake. The story reached Buckkeep that he had, in a temper, struck the child of a servant, and left the girl a witling. That was sufficient to raid King Shrewd's lip. The lordling had paid the full blood debt, and by accepting it, the servant had given up any form of the king's justice. But some months later, There came to court a cousin of the girl's, and she petitioned for private audience with Shrewd. I was sent to confirm her tale, and saw how the girl was kept like a dog at the foot of the lordling's chair, and more, how her belly had begun to swell with child. And so it was not too difficult, as he offered me wine and fine crystal, and begged the latest news of the king's court at Buckkeep, for me to find a time to lift his glass to the light, and praise the quality of both vessel and wine. I left some days later, my errand completed, and the samples of paper I had promised for Fedrin, and the conveyed wishes of the lordling for a good trip home. The lordling was indisposed that day. He died, in blood and madness and froth, a month or so later. The cousin took in both girl and child. To this day, I have no regrets for the deed or for the choice of slow death for him. And when I was not dealing death to forged ones, I waited on my lord Prince Verity. I remember the first time I climbed all those stairs to his tower, balancing a tray as I went. I had expected a guard or sentry at the top. There was none. I tapped at the door and received no answer, entered quietly. Verity was sitting in a chair by the window. A summer wind off the ocean blew into the room. It could have been a pleasant chamber, full of light and air on a stuffy summer day. Instead, it seemed to me a cell. There was a chair by the window and a small table next to it. In the corners and around the edges of the room, the floor was dusty and littered with bits of old strewing reeds. And Verity, chin slumped to his chest as if dozing, except that to my senses the room thrummed with his effort. His hair was unkempt, his chin bewhiskered with a day's growth. His clothing hung on him. I pushed the door shut with my foot and took the tray to the table. I set it down and stood beside it, quietly waiting, and in a few minutes he came back from wherever he had been. He looked up at me with a ghost of his old smile, and then down at his tray. "What's this?"
"Breakfast, sir. Everyone else ate hours ago, save yourself."
"I ate, boy, early this morning. Some awful fish soup. The cook should be hanged for that. No one should face fish first thing in the morning."
He seemed uncertain, like some doddering gaffer, trying to recall the days of his youth.
"That was yesterday, sir."
I uncovered the plates. Warm bread swirled with honey and raisins, cold meats, a dish of strawberries, and a small pot of cream for them. All were small portions, almost a child's serving. I poured the steaming tea into a waiting mug. It was flavored heavily with ginger and peppermint to cover the ground elf bark's tang. Verity glanced at it, and then up to me.
"Chade never relents, does he?"
Spoken so casually, as if Chade's name were mentioned every day about the keep.
"You need to eat if you are to continue," I said neutrally.
"I suppose,"
he said wearily, and turned to the tray as if the artfully arranged food were yet another duty to attend. He ate with no relish for the food, and drank the tea in a manful draught as a medicine, undeceived by ginger or mint. Halfway through the meal he paused with a sigh and gazed out the window for a bit. Then, seeming to come back again, he forced himself to consume each item completely. He pushed the tray aside and leaned back in the chair as if exhausted. I stared. I had prepared the tea myself. That much elf bark would have had Sooty leaping over the stall walls.
"My prince," I said,
and when he did not stir, I touched his shoulder lightly.
"Verity, are you all right?"
"Verity,"
he repeated, as in a daze.
"Yes. And I prefer that to sir or my prince. Oh, my lord, this is my father's gambit to send you. Well, I may surprise him yet, but yes, call me Verity. And tell them I ate. Obedient as ever, I ate. Go on now, boy, I have work to do."
He seemed to roust himself with an effort, and once more his gaze went afar. I stacked the dishes as quietly as I could atop the tray and headed toward the door. But as I lifted the latch, he spoke again.
"Boy?"
"Sir?"
"Ah,"
he warned me.
"Verity?"
"Leon is in my rooms, boy. Take him out for me, will you? He pines. There is no sense in the both of us shriveling like this."
"Yes, sir. Verity."
And so, the old hound, past his prime now, came to be in my care. Each day I took him from Verity's room, and we hunted the back hills and cliffs and the beaches for wolves that had not run there in a score of years. As Chade had suspected, I was badly out of condition, and at first it was all I could do to keep up, even with the old hound. But as the days went by, we regained our tone, and Leon even caught a rabbit or two for me. Now that I was exiled from Burridge's domain, I did not scruple to use the wit whenever I wished. But as I had discovered long ago, I could communicate with Leon, but there was no bond. He did not always heed me, nor even believe me all the time. Had he been but a pup, I am sure we could have bonded to one another, but he was old, and his heart given forever to Verity. The wit was not dominion over beasts, but only a glimpse into their lives. And thrice a day I climbed the steeply winding steps to coax Verity to eat, and to a few words of conversation. Some days it was like speaking to a child or a doddering oldster. On others, he asked after Leon, and quizzed me about matters down in Buckkeep Town. Sometimes I was absent for days on my other assignments. Usually, he seemed not to have noticed, but once, after the foray in which I took my knife wound, he watched me awkwardly load his empty dishes onto the tray. "How they must laugh in their beards, if they know we slay our own." I froze, wondering what answer to make to that. For as far as I knew, my tasks were known only to Shrewd and Chade. But Verity's eyes had gone afar again, and I left silently. Without intending to, I began to make changes around him. One day, while he was eating, I swept the room, and later that evening brought up in a separate trip a sack full of strewing reeds and herbs. I had worried that I might be a distraction to him, but Chade had taught me to move quietly. I worked without speaking to him, and as for Verity, he acknowledged neither my coming nor going. But the room was freshened, and the vivaria blossoms mixed in with the strewing herbs were an enlivening scent. Coming in once, I discovered him dozing in his hard-backed chair. I brought up cushions, which he ignored for several days, and then, one day, had arranged to his liking. The room remained bare, but I sensed he needed it so to preserve his single-mindedness. So what I brought him were the barest items of comfort. No tapestries or wall hangings, no vases of flowers or tinkling wind chimes, but flowering thymes in pots to ease the headaches that plagued him, and on one stormy day a blanket against the rain and chill from the open window. On that day I found him sleeping in his chair, limp as a dead thing. I tucked the blanket around him as if he were an invalid, and set the tray before him, but left it covered to keep the good heat in the food. I sat down on the floor next to his chair, propped against one of his discarded cushions, and listened to the silence of the room. It seemed almost peaceful today, despite the driving summer rain outside the open window, and the gale wind that gusted in from time to time. I must have dozed, for I woke to his hand on my hair.
"Do they tell you to watch over me so, boy, even when I sleep?"
"What do they fear, then?"
"Not that I know, Verity. They tell me only to bring you food and see as best I can that you eat it. No more than that. And blankets and cushions and pots of sweet flowers. My own doing, my prince. No man should live in such a desert as this." And in that moment, I realized we were not speaking aloud, and sat bolt upright and looked at him. Verity, too, seemed to come to himself.
He shifted in his comfortless chair.
I bless this storm that lets me rest. I hid it from thee of their ships, persuading those who looked to the sky that it was no more than a summer squall. Now they ply their oars and peer through the rain, trying to keep their courses, and I can snatch a few moments of honest sleep. He paused. I ask your pardon, boy. Sometimes now the skilling seems more natural than speaking. I did not mean to intrude on you. No matter, my prince. I was but startled. I cannot skill myself except weakly and erratically. I do not know how I opened to you. Verity, boy, not your prince. No one's prince sits still in a sweaty shirt with 2 days of beard. But what is this nonsense? Surely it was arranged for you to learn the skill. I remember well how Patience's tongue battered away my father's resolve. He permitted himself a weary smile. Galen tried to teach me, but I had not the aptitude. With bastards, I'm told it is often...
Wait,
he growled, and in an instant was within my head.
This is faster,
he offered, by way of apology, and then, muttering to himself,
what is this that clouds you so?
Ah!
And was gone again from my mind, and all as deft and easy as Burridge taking a tick off a hound's ear. He sat long, quiet, and so did I, wondering.
I am strong in it, as was your father. Galen is not.
Then how did he become skillmaster? I asked quietly. I wondered if Verity was saying this only to somehow make me feel my failure less. Verity paused as if skirting a delicate subject.
Galen was Queen Desire's pet, a favorite. The queen emphatically suggested Galen as apprentice to Solicity. Often I think our old skillmaster was desperate when she took him as apprentice. Solicity knew she was dying, you see. I believe she acted in haste and, toward the end, regretted her decision. And I do not think he had half the training he should have had before becoming master. But there he is what we have.